because we forgot that we belong to one another. We have a tremendous propensity in the cannabis community to character assassinate, to mercilessly judge each other, to not forgive each other, to not give each other the benefit of the doubt. And I'm telling you, it is not the path to the healing of the nations. Please refrain from your, no matter how justified you feel in that moment of emotion for that social media post, it always reflects worse on the poster than it ever does on the subject of your post, no matter how much you think that they deserve some type of public shaming. It is always a shame on ourselves. Please remember that, my tribe. Let's love each other. Let's heal this thing up. Let's donate to Seattle Hemp Fest, because I tell you now, we wouldn't be here without them. Thank you.
So what a wonderful portion of insight and inspiration coming from Joy Beckerman.
If you have an interest in all things cannabis and would like to help us put these shows together, you can email me, Ed Melnick, here at the KBOO website. I'd like to thank associate producers Mindy Griffiths and Barry Height for their additions to the show today. The State of Cannabis airs on the fourth Friday of every month between 5:30 and 6 p.m. I hope you'll join us again next month for more on the State of Cannabis. Till then, this is Ed Melnick wishing you all the best.
Your papers, please.
I only have a pipe, man.
It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Pan-African Women's Day, Saturday, August 27th at In Other Words Bookstore in Portland. A panel of African women from different organizations will be highlighting the issues impacting African women across the globe, and to highlight the necessity for African women to be united and organized on a worldwide basis against imperialism. Edutainment and childcare will be provided. Again, that's Pan-African Women's Day, Saturday, August 27th at 5:30 p.m. at In Other Words Bookstore, 14 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Avalon Sanctuary Fundraiser, Saturday, August 27th from 4 to 9 p.m. at 19th and Avalon in Southeast Portland. Avalon Sanctuary is a dead-end street that is being turned into a community green space. The first part of the event will be an open bluegrass jam, and storytellers will share the history of inner Southeast Portland. Again, that's Avalon Sanctuary Fundraiser on Saturday, August 27th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Southeast 19th and Avalon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Barely have the floodwaters in Louisiana receded that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has auctioned off new leases of federal water to fossil fuel companies for offshore drilling. We'll turn to Ann Rolfes of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade for more. And we'll go to the site of ongoing protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, dubbed Camp Sacred Stone, to speak with Wiaka Eagleman of the Sichangu Lakota tribe. He's been camping out since April 1st to stop the crude oil project. Plus, researcher and author Matthew Wolfmeyer joins me to discuss the politics of sleep in his new book, The Slumbering Masses: Sleep, Medicine, and the Modern American Life. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Before we start our show today, I want to make an important announcement. After just about a year since my previous show, Uprising, was on Free Speech TV, I will be returning to FSTV's airwaves on Monday. This program, Rising Up with Sonali, will debut on Free Speech TV Monday, August 29th at 3 p.m. Pacific. That's 6 p.m. Eastern. So please do tune in. Free Speech TV is available on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. Despite historic levels of flooding in Louisiana that killed over a dozen people and forced hundreds of thousands out of their homes, the U.S. government's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, decided to go ahead and auction off leases to millions of acres of Gulf Coast waters for offshore drilling. Activists attempted to attend the auction, and four people holding a banner saying more drilling equals more flooding were arrested. The lease auction came as President Obama toured flood-stricken areas of Louisiana. Meanwhile, a new report released by the Center for Biological Diversity this week denounces offshore drilling. It's called Critical Gulf: The Vital Importance of Ending New Fossil Fuel Leases in the Gulf of Mexico. My guest is Anne Rolfes. She's the founding director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Welcome to the program, Anne.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So first, let's talk about the auction itself. This is obviously not the first time the BOEM has done that. Neither is it the first time that protesters have attended the auction. But I understand that this time the BOEM tried a little harder to keep the public away from the auction itself.
Yeah, well, you featured our action last March, in which we had 300 people show up at that auction, delivering a very clear message. We said the Gulf is not for sale, over and over again to the crowd of people who were there to bid. But what they did this time is they decided they had a very carefully worded press release in which they said that public participation was no longer necessary, and that they had decided this after talking with stakeholders. That can only be the oil industry. So they didn't let anybody in. Instead, they live streamed it, which proves that we were effective.
So basically, they thought that simply allowing the public to view without participating in the lease auction live would be enough. Still, four people managed to make it at least in front of the building. Tell us exactly what played out on Wednesday.
Yeah, so what happened is that the auction itself was on Wednesday, and we went to their office the day before, in part to make a last-ditch effort to get President Obama to cancel the auction. And so we went there. A group of us occupied the building, or at least the front of the building, as far as they would let us in, and said that we wouldn't leave until President Obama canceled the sale. A really, really important part of this, Sonali, is that we brought with us debris from Baton Rouge from the floods. So early in the morning, there was a team that assembled a big pile of flood debris so that when BOEM workers walked in that day, they saw it. And our message, as you stated, is very clear. We're having these floods because of all this drilling and the dependence on fossil fuels.
Again, BOEM is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Let's actually tease apart that statement. I mean, it sounds simplistic. More drilling equals more flooding. That was the message on the banner. But connect the dots for us. How would more drilling cause more flooding? You're not talking about drilling actually, leading to the ocean directly getting onto the land. You're talking about the impacts of fossil fuel burning, right?
Right. And if we drill this oil and we burn this oil, we make the atmosphere warm. When the air is warmer, it holds more moisture. When the air holds more moisture, it rains and we have flooding. What was very interesting, and you probably noticed this, was that the media, even the mainstream media, really connected the dots between climate change and this flooding. The lead sentence in the New York Times in one of those articles was, when climate change arrives, it will not announce itself, but it will look very much like the flooding in Louisiana. And those are the dots that we're connecting.
Right, and I think that's a really important point. Obviously, the area, the state, is one that has been prone to annual flooding. But as you said, climate change doesn't announce itself with a bang. It is something that can happen quite unpredictably. And the amount of water, of rain that was dumped onto areas of Louisiana over the last week and a half was unprecedented. The trillions of gallons of water. Right?
Yeah, and I think an important point too is that a lot of the places that flooded had never flooded before. For example, I grew up in a town called Lafayette, which is in the southwestern part of the state. My neighborhood never flooded. My childhood home never came close to flooding. It's on a hill, in fact, and it flooded this time. And so I think that's the point, is that more and more people are growing vulnerable, that we're going to have these rainstorms. They may not be hurricanes, but they're going to be rainstorms and flooding like we've never seen. In the reporting this week, I'm sure y'all have read that a lot of people didn't have flood insurance. And that's because these are not areas that have traditionally flooded.
So because these are not areas that have traditionally flooded, a lot of people are, of course, going to be relying on federal aid. Over 100,000 people are slated to apply for federal aid this time. Let's talk about the role of the federal government. President Obama earlier chastised for not visiting the state, even though the state's governor defended him. He did come on the same day as the leases were being auctioned. I imagine that there's great irony in that. Right?
There's so much irony. This whole situation is full of irony. I mean, the fact that we had a flood and that, we're announcing more drilling on the same day. Also, let's look at the location of this auction that they have. You know, for years now, they have auctioned off our Gulf of Mexico in the Superdome. What's the Superdome? It was what they called the refuge of last resort during Hurricane Katrina. And anyone who remembers back in 2005 saw hundreds of, African Americans for the most part filing into the Superdome. And it was a terrible situation in there. So they even do their bidding for the drilling in the place that is, show the climate change disaster. It's unbelievable.
Now, so what is the role that President Obama takes in enabling these leases? This is his administration. And obviously, as president, he may not be involved in the day-to-day matters of one lease here or there. But what is his position as president on offshore drilling? It was the Republican Party at their last convention that kind of popularized the perverse phrase, drill, baby, drill. Yet under a Democratic administration, we see drilling continuing.
Yes, and we see drilling continuing specifically in the Gulf of Mexico, and it becomes more and more clear all the time that we really are the sacrifice zone for drilling. For example, just in the last several months, there was the idea that perhaps the federal government would open up the Atlantic coast for drilling. And what did the administration do under the leadership of Obama? They elected not to drill off the Atlantic coast, and we're very happy about that. Look at the Arctic. There is a temporary ban on drilling there for about 2 years. That was also under the leadership of President Obama. So in some areas, he's made really great decisions, not allowing Keystone to go through. And yet, the one area in which this idea of drill, baby, drill is still prominent is in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's our job, right, is to continue to deliver the message that we, the people of this region, no longer want it.
We're here in California, and where maybe my California audience and certainly myself don't fully appreciate how vast the industry in the Gulf Coast is, the fossil fuel industry is already. Now, setting aside the leases for new offshore drilling, how concentrated, if you will, are offshore operations currently in the Gulf?
Well, it certainly is a very prominent part of the culture. I mean, when you and the situation here, when you're in certain towns, you see signs for different sorts of oil field services company. Everything from helicopters to the Gulf to caterers to people that make pipelines and go and lay pipelines. So it's very prominent, and it's why the industry has had a stranglehold on our elected officials for so long. But I think we have a very, very strong argument, and I know that I've said this to you before, that there are plenty of jobs right now in the industry. You know, this whole false idea that the industry tries to set up that we are going to make, you know, a big job loss in this part of the country, it's really quite false. Because if they really cared about jobs, they would hire thousands of people now to attend to their abandoned wells in the Gulf of Mexico. Sonali, they have 26,000 abandoned oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico.
Wow.
There's a lot of work to be done.
So this report that the Center for Biological Diversity released, Critical Gulf, points out that unleased fossil fuels today account for approximately half of the potential greenhouse gas pollution from all remaining fossil fuels in the United States. So we are talking about the federal government essentially controlling fossil fuel potential, fossil fuel pollution potential. And it's actually, instead of leaving the oil in the ground or beneath the ocean floor, as is this case, the government is going ahead and enabling oil corporations, fossil fuel corporations, to reach the soil through these leases. Why is it doing that? What is it? What is the government's interest?
You know, that's a great question, because if you look at what President Obama has said with around climate, that it's important to him through the Paris Accords, this action doesn't make sense. So you can only imagine that it's political pressure. But even the political pressure I find questionable, because all the people who are giving him a hard time about this will never like him anyway, right? I mean, it's stalwart Republicans, to be sure, certainly some Democrats in this part of the world. But, you know, it's time for a change, and I can't quite figure out why, you know, leave us alone as the sacrifice zone. I mean, what I do know is that it's our job, it's my personal job, to make the point we don't want it anymore.
Right. So basically, Obama technically seems to have nothing politically to lose. However, of course, the Democratic Party has been beholden, like the Republican Party, to fossil fuel interests, to Wall Street interests, et cetera. I want to talk about the ordinary Louisianans on the ground, not your organization and activists who really connect the dots between drilling and flooding, but ordinary Louisianans who've been directly impacted, and how they view, if it's even on their radar, the auctioning of these leases. Is this something that there's awareness of on the ground?
People aren't aware of it. And when you tell them, did you know that last March, for example, the federal government auctioned 43 million acres of our Gulf of Mexico? Most people are aghast. They simply don't know it's happening.
Wow. And so if they were to have that public awareness and connect the dots between that and the flooding that has devastated their lives, you would see a very different response. How much news coverage have your protests gotten? You said that because of the timing, perhaps this week with the floods, mainstream media at least this time made the connection between the leases and climate change?
No, absolutely not. We certainly got national coverage of our action on Tuesday. There was a little bit of local coverage. You know, the local papers and the local media are really busy focusing on the floods themselves and less about, you know, why does this flooding happen? What are our risks in the future? And we're still in a situation here in which the idea of recognizing climate change is seen as a political idea rather than simply a scientific fact. Just look at our elected representatives. Our congressional representatives in the southern part of the state, including Representative Steve Scalise, who is the House Majority Whip, they are climate deniers, hardcore climate deniers. Charles Bustani, who is the representative from Lafayette, my hometown, that got terribly flooded, hardcore climate denier. And yet they represent some of the most vulnerable districts in the United States. Now, there was a Los Angeles Times story this week about our congressional delegation withholding their vote for recovery funds for Hurricane Sandy. But what that story didn't look at was how very vulnerable to climate change and sea level rise these very districts are. And I think that's a story that's not been told that needs to be.
Hmm. So, Anne, at this point, what will happen with these leases if the public has been kept out of these auctions and basically now the kind of action you had in March seems to not be possible? How do you stop these leases? What are the next plans? And is there another auction of leases planned in the coming future?
Yes, there's another one planned for March and then another one in April. And unless we intervene and stop these, it will go on and on and on. So I think we have two factors that are working in our favor. One has been the price of oil. And it is true now that these oil companies own these leases. But if it is not profitable for them to go and drill for that oil, then perhaps they'll never be touched. So that would certainly be good news. But the second
So what you're saying is, ironically, the low price of oil, which of course sadly ends up increasing oil consumption, makes it less lucrative for oil companies to actually go and drill?
Yes, I think it's an unintended benefit of these low prices. I believe that most of us who do this kind of work always thought that when oil was really expensive is when we would start to phase it out. But, you know, if you think, just use common sense, it makes sense that when oil is so expensive, these guys are making a lot of money. So right now, it's harder for them because the price of oil is low. I want to point out that they consider that they're not making money. They're still making money. They're just not making the ludicrous profits they're used to. And I think this greed factor is a very, very important dynamic. You know, they're starting to lay people off and they're blaming the economy and they're blaming people like me for driving the price down. In fact, you know, they're greedy, right? They have an unhealthy idea of how much money they have to make. And I know, I grew up surrounded by people, right? You know, buying fancy sports cars to send their kids to high school in, right? Fancy clothes, big parties. I mean, I know the lifestyle of some of these oil guys, and it's greed.
Give out a website for Louisiana Bucket Brigade.
The website is labucketbrigade.org. And we also have a website for the campaign to end drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. It's called nonewleases.org.
That's nonewleases.org. We'll post a link to both those websites from our site later today. And thank you, as always, for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Anne Rolfes is the founding director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Before we start our show today, I want to make an important announcement. After just about a year since my previous show, Uprising, was on Free Speech TV, I will be returning to FSTV's airwaves on Monday. This program, Rising Up with Sonali, will debut on Free Speech TV Monday, August 29th at 3 p.m. Pacific. That's 6 p.m. Eastern. So please do tune in. Free Speech TV is available on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. It has been nearly 5 months since an occupation in North Dakota to stop construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline began. But only in the past several weeks has the major national media taken notice. Thousands of indigenous people and environmental activists, led by members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, have camped out near the Cannonball River. They're calling the space Sacred Stone Camp. And their effort to stop the pipeline has been met by heavy police presence and arrests. There have even been some reports of cell service being cut to the area. Still, the occupation continues to grow. The Dakota Access Pipeline was quietly approved by federal regulators even as activists were celebrating the rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline. The Dakota Access Pipeline is only 7 miles shorter than Keystone. Today, we go live to Sacred Stone Camp to speak with one activist who's been camping there since April 1st, when the occupation began. Wiyaka Eagleman is member of the Sichangu Lakota tribe. Welcome to the program, Wiyaka.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we're very excited to have you on. You're joining us from the edge of the campgrounds, where you're able to get self-service. Tell us, take us back to April 1st. What led you to begin this occupation? How many others were there with you when it first began?
Yeah, on April 1st, there was a call from Standing Rock Reservation to my people in Rosebud to come and set up camp here to resist the Dakota Access Pipeline. Our first camp was behind me on that hill over there. But due to the weather here, the wind, we moved down here by the river.
And we can hear that wind pretty strongly in our interview right now. So you've sort of have to move around a little bit since April 1st. But what prompted you, what motivated you to heed this call to come and begin this occupation in April?
This isn't my first battle. My first battle was Keystone XL. I was trying to run through my reservation in Rosebud. This is drinking water here. We get it down there too. All of our nations down south get it. So water. You know, it's very important that I look after my future, or my kids' future.
And so, did you expect to stay this long and for it to grow this much? Today, I understand there's something like 2,000 people there?
Yeah, there's a little over 3,000 people. They come and go from all across the world. I didn't expect it to come this far, especially the construction. 70% of North Dakota's pipeline is already in the ground, 100% of South Dakota, and 40% of Iowa's pipeline is already in the ground.
And so this pipeline, which cuts across four states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois, was approved by federal regulators, even though President Obama rejected the other pipeline, Keystone XL, that you also protested against. It approved, regulators approved this pipeline. So right now, what is the status of the construction? Have you and your fellow activists managed to stop it, at least temporarily, at least for now?
Yes, we were on the front lines for a whole week straight, stopping the construction from doing any more damage to the land. Across the land, straight across over there, they still have their bulldozers and backhoes. They're still there. They're just waiting on the word from the Pentagon to continue with construction. As you see, way over there, right there, there's the second camp. It's called the Red Warrior Camp, and that's where most of the people are.
I see. Wiyaka, can you give us a survey with your phone that you are on right now of the land for our TV audience? My guest, Wiyaka Eagleman, who is a member of the Sichangu Lakota tribe, is at Sacred Stone Camp. He's showing us a view of the Cannonball River and this wide open sort of prairie land that the Dakota Access Pipeline will be going through. There is a campground with, he said, now 3,000 plus people that have been set up there to attempt to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. So my guest, Wiyaka Eagleman, back in his car now to protect himself and his camera and phone from the wind. Wiyaka, can you link the battle that is playing out right now between activists like yourself and the U.S. government to history?
This falls back into the Battle of Little Bighorn, Wounded Knee, of how the government is treating our people. You know, the land that they're on right now, it's sacred to Standing Rock. There's burial grounds, old rock cairns from back in the day. This company or the government knows where these are at because they don't live here. The people live here.
And in terms of the camp growing. Tell us about how exactly other people have been joining you. You heeded the call from Standing Rock Sioux on April 1st, but I understand just in the past few weeks, other indigenous communities have sent their representatives. The camp is growing bigger. We've seen some dramatic images of, you know, people ceremonially coming in on horseback. Tell us a little bit about how the camp has been growing, particularly how other indigenous communities have seen this effort as part of a collective struggle.
It comes down to the first day when we started doing our blockades. There was only 10 of us at our camp here, and we put it out to the world to see what we're doing with resisting this company to come into the lands. And I think that's what got a lot of people's attention. There's people from all over the world that just showed up with solidarity and Standing Rock.
And for our TV audience, we have a video playing right now of the arrival of the Comanche Nation members that were greeted. There's a large bus load of people who have come in. How do they see this struggle, Wiaka, as a kind of broader struggle? How did they, I mean, this impacts North Dakota, South Dakota, it impacts the Missouri River, but why are, you know, First Nations people from Canada arriving here? Why do they see this as part of their struggle too?
You know, this, in my eyes, you know, this isn't just a native issue. You know, this is a good start as indigenous people to, you know, take all battles in hand. And, you know, I think it's important that all races of mankind come together, get together and see how we could work on each other's issues. This isn't the only battle right now. They can bring their struggle here and we can help them.
As far as you can tell, what is the breakdown of the activists there, indigenous versus non-indigenous?
There's over 87 nations represented here. As far as I know, there's more indigenous people than whites.
What has life been like at the camp, just in terms of practical issues? You've been living there since April. You're basically camping out for nearly 5 months. Can you tell, give me a sense of what the day-to-day life is like on the camp?
Day-to-day, you know, we try to have our wood and water stocked. We've held a fire, an open fire that's been lit for over 4 months now. We try to keep that going day and night, 24/7. You know, we take turns cooking meals. We take turns looking after the children. We sit back, we tell stories of, we try to learn the history of the land from the elders. We try to bring fun and humor into what's going on here.
And I understand the rules are pretty strict at the camp. No alcohol, no drugs, and that no weapons, etc. Is that true?
Yes, that's very true. We don't even let the tribal police in here. Behind you got a pretty good security crew. They got it always fenced off. It's secured 24/7 too.
And what is that security crew's job? I mean, what are you worried about?
Infiltrators, people that don't know what's going on here, that just came here, that don't know anybody here, federal agents, news crews.
Why would you not want a news crew to come into the camp? Are you worried about the kind of news coverage that you would get?
Yeah, lately the local media has been putting false statements out there from the camp, saying that we are a violent camp. One action we had, our people, you know, we carry a sacred pipe with us in ceremony, and you know, we were just asking our people to pray and load our pipes, and the media took it and blasted it all over North Dakota, saying that we had pipe bombs here, loading our pipe bombs. And you know, so now the feds are going to get involved, but you know, they don't know the truth what's going on here. They're just all local media is doing that, and you know, it's very understanding that big oil companies are paying North Dakota government to, you know, work against us. It's been that way for years.
What about the local residents in and around the North Dakota area and where this pipeline will be going through? Because I understand that the majority of the pipeline will actually travel under private land. And so the company has been working with private landowners to get rights from them. But then parts of it, of course, go under the Missouri River. Do you see any solidarity from private landowners, or are most of them more than happy to let this pipeline through their land?
Most of them are, they're happy with what they got offered to them. You know, it's all about money to these landowners, especially where the buffalo roam on the north side of the river. apparently they don't care about the health of the buffalo, and we got eagle nestings around here. You know, we reached out to landowners. They did not cooperate. Some of them got forced into making their decision. They were either offered money or, you know, we're just gonna take your land anyway. You know, that's how disseminated domain works around here.
At this point, what do you foresee for the future of this encampment, Sacred Stone Camp? Now, for a few days, you said you were physically in the way of construction with the bulldozers, but now what's the camp's main goal? Is it mostly sort of symbolic to draw attention to the Dakota Access Pipeline?
We're trying to reach out to national media to see, or observers to come and participate and see what's happening to these people. We started out with just our own local media, and it's just shot around the world. So we're still inviting people. This camp is always going to be here. You know, it's going to be up to Congress on whether they allow them to drill under the river or not.
And so where can people find out about it? I'm sure there might be people among my audience who see what an important issue this is to them personally, and might be interested in expressing solidarity either by coming themselves or by getting more media to cover you. Is there a website? How can people reach the camp?
Yeah, we got a website. It's sacredstonecamp.org. On Facebook, it's No Dakota Access in Treaty Territory.
Can I just ask you a personal question? You've been here since April. What has it been like for you? I mean, is your family here with you, or if you have children, are they with you? How are you explaining that to your family, etc.?
Thank you for asking that question. You know, I didn't reach out to people on my personal issue, but it's been really emotional here for me because I lost family members back home, deaths. I lost my personal family. All I have left is my kids. Over the years, it's been tough. But I made a commitment to my kids. I'm going to fight if it's for the rest of my life, for the safety of their future. And you know, I try my best to go home every now and then. It's hard. I don't have transportation. You know, I'm still living oppressed, and you know, I still have a lot of feelings inside where I still need to take care of myself. You know, if it's good to have friends out there that understand where I'm coming from, because you know, this isn't easy. It's not easy to live off the land. It's not easy to be out here in the open. You know, it's, thank you for asking that question.
How many children do you have? How old are they?
I have 5 children. My oldest is 8, 6, 5, 3, and 1.
And are they with you at the camp?
No, they're with their mother.
So you feel like your work, your presence at this camp is for their future?
Yes.
And do you think that they're all very young. Maybe your 8-year-old grasps why you're there?
Yeah, you know, my older children, they know why I'm here. They've spent time with me at this other camp, resisting another pipeline. They know what I'm doing. It's just, I'm worried about my younger kids, the separation. And, you know, I really hope we stop this pipeline soon so I can go home and take care of my kids.
You mentioned earlier that all your life you felt the sort of government oppression. Can you give me a little bit more detail about that, a little example of that? Because I think it's important that this is not just one issue that a lot of Native communities are dealing with, but this is one of many issues and a long-standing history, right?
Yeah, you know, the government, they place us on these reservations. You know, we have like the poorest housing rate. They take away our language. They forced our parents into boarding schools where my uncles and aunties, you know, they were beat. They were, you know, molested in schools like that. And, you know, it just got passed down to my generation where there's a lot of alcoholism growing up, living with, you know, no electricity, have to haul water, and also taking care of my cousins and my nieces. My generation, you know, we took care of each other. Our parents were never there. just our grandparents. And, you know, it was hard to understand how schooling went, because it, you know, living out in a country like that, you don't trust anybody. You don't even trust your older relatives.
How old are you?
Yeah, I'm 28 years old.
So you feel that your generation, you've had to mostly look out for yourselves because of some of the systemic issues that have impacted your parents?
Yes.
So here you are at Sacred Stone Camp. Have you found community in the camp? Have you found, you mentioned people sitting around and telling stories and sharing oral histories from elders. Have you found a value to the camp beyond stopping the pipeline, but to your own sense of purpose?
Yes. You know, just spending time with the local community members to see how they feel about it, sitting around an open fire and visiting with, you know, the new people and seeing where they come from. I think it's important to know how each other feels about what's happening in our lives right now.
Well, we will post those websites that you mentioned earlier on our website later today. Wiyaka, I want to thank you so much for sharing this time with us, sharing, you know, sort of your own feelings about your background and why you're there. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest, Wiyaka Eagleman, is member of the Sichangu Lakota tribe. He's been living at Sacred Stone Camp since April 1st, an encampment that has basically sprung up in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Before we start our show today, I want to make an important announcement. After just about a year since my previous show, Uprising, was on Free Speech TV, I will be returning to FSTV's airwaves on Monday. This program, Rising Up with Sonali, will debut on Free Speech TV Monday, August 29th at 3 p.m. Pacific, that's 6 p.m. Eastern, so please do tune in. Free Speech TV is available on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. Sleep, we are told, is as important for our health as diet and exercise. If we don't get our recommended 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep every night, we are told that we will incur greater risks of heart disease and diabetes. We will gain weight, weaken our immune systems, and increase our blood pressure. If we suffer from insomnia, pharmaceutical and even natural health companies are there at the ready with myriad sleep aids, artificial and natural, to help us achieve the requisite uninterrupted 8 hours of sleep. But how have sleeping patterns and expectations of sleep changed over the years? And what does capitalism and productivity have to do with it? Exploring the politics of sleep in a new book is my guest, Matthew J. Wolfmeyer. He is an associate professor of anthropology at Binghamton University, and his book is called The Slumbering Masses, Sleep, Medicine, and the Modern American Life. Welcome to the program, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
How did this whole book begin with you? Where did your interest arise? This is a very intimate aspect of American lives, something that we feel is just, you know, an issue between us and our doctor. But your book explodes that idea. Did this stem from your own sleeping habits?
Yeah, I throughout high school, I was always sort of a problem sleeper. I went to sleep really late at night. I had to wake up really early to go to school, would end up taking naps after school. And so that had kind of primed me to be paying attention to sleep in some ways. When I went to college, I ended up working at a job where I was working in the middle of the night. So I would work from 10 p.m. until 8 a.m. And having that kind of alternative sleep schedule was always really okay with me, but a lot of my coworkers struggled with it. And so all of that had kind of laid the foundation for me to be paying attention to sleep. And then when I was actually working on my dissertation, the topic came up and I visited a sleep clinic. I just realized that there was a lot that could, or looking at sleep allowed me to open up all sorts of different avenues for research. And because sleep is so central in all of our lives, it was a way to connect issues around labor and education and family life and recreation and the history of capitalism in a way that was really compelling to me.
Now, one of the things you just pointed out, which is that you didn't have much of a problem with sleeping during the day, being awake at night, but a lot of your coworkers did. That idea hints to this fact that sleeping patterns might be highly individualized. Yet where did this notion that we all need to have 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep at night arise from? Is this a fairly new idea?
It's about 200 years old. And the history that I am tracing in the book is this interest in sleep that coincides with the industrialization of labor in North America and in Western Europe. And so the historical documents that we have, and they include things like diaries, but also really early medical books of various sorts, show that for a long time, people were sleeping in what we commonly think of as biphasic sleep. So the idea is that people either go to sleep around sundown, they stay asleep for a few hours, wake up in the middle of the night for a period, which can be an hour or 2 hours or longer, go back to sleep for a few more hours, wake up around dawn, go to work. The other model is the sort of siesta culture model, which is that, you know, you stay up really late, you sleep for a few hours in the middle of the night, you work through the day until it gets too hot, you take a, you know, long nap in the middle of the day, and that keeps you up late at night. And so what happens with the rise of factory labor is people are moving towards really long work days where there's no opportunity for taking a nap, and they have to be there at the crack of dawn, and they stay there until dusk because factory managers are trying to get as much free lighting as they possibly can since there's no electricity yet. And so people move from having this kind of flexible schedule to having a really consolidated work schedule, which means that they also need to have a consolidated sleep schedule. And so the idea becomes that you need to sleep at night so that you can work during the day. And over about 40 years between 1840 and 1880, there are a lot of debates or discussions, they're not really debates, on the part of physicians and early scientists about the naturalness of consolidated sleep. And by the turn of the 20th century, basically everybody agrees that consolidated sleep is the norm and it should be at night, so that as the science of sleep is around, that's really the assumption that everybody is working from. They're not working from the idea that we're biphasic sleepers or that we need naps or that sleep could be arranged differently.
So Matthew, what you're saying is that essentially the idea, modern idea of uninterrupted 8 hours of sleep at night is a notion that stems from needing to arrange modern human life around the demands of capitalist work schedules.
Yes, absolutely. So
so left to our own devices, we would sleep how? And how do we answer that question?
The other ways that we can sleep aren't necessarily anti-capitalist, right? That you can imagine a world in which there are napping facilities in every workplace and that we could come to work late and leave late. I mean, that's flex time, and a lot of people in the kind of creative class or white collar work have jobs that are like that. The challenge is that often when companies have experimented with things like napping rooms in their workplaces, people don't want to use them because they don't want to be seen as the kind of person who needs to take a nap. And similarly, when people have flex time, they often don't use it very much because they don't want to be seen as the person who's coming into work late all the time, right? So there are these stigmas attached to non-normative behavior around wakefulness and sleep. So we could organize things differently. We could make different kinds of allowances, and in fact, many places do. But at the same time, society and its ordering really depends on people having relatively static schedules, right? So kids are just about to go back to school or have just gone back to school, and you know they need to be in the door by 8 o'clock so that they can be picked up by 2:30 or 4 o'clock, depending on where you are. And parents need them to be there so that they can go to work, and they have basically free childcare, right? And so if you start tinkering with how we sleep and what allowances we make around it, all of these institutions that depend on that kind of static ordering of life are going to have to make adjustments.
And yet then you have people whose natural sleep patterns, if you will, just don't fit within that framework. And those people struggle and struggle and struggle. And you have now this industry of sleep aids that is ready to help. You can take a pill to go to sleep. You can take a pill or a cup of coffee or caffeinated soda to stay awake. How big is the industry around sleeping and waking in terms of the chemical industry, I should say?
If you're talking about dollar figures, that's a difficult thing to track because the industry is so large. At various times I've tried to quantify it all, and I think between something like soft drinks and like caffeinated soft drinks, so Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and the largest drug manufacturers who make sleep aids, you're already somewhere around $20 billion a year. If you tap into the pharmaceutical makers who make things like Tylenol PM, or the energy drink makers, or coffee producers, like it's an enormous industry. And as you start to think about how much caffeine is in our lives, or how many things that we use to help go to sleep at night, it might not just be Ambien and Lunesta, but also things like Tylenol PM. It might be a glass of wine. The industry is enormous and multi-headed, right?
So let's also talk about how the anxieties around not getting enough sleep might feed into the problem. Do doctors constantly tell us that there's this whole host of disorders that we could trigger if we don't get enough sleep every night, or if we don't get that uninterrupted nighttime sleep? Are those overblown, and are those also relatively new ideas in the realm of health and medicine?
It's definitely over the last 15 years, sleep has become more central in medical conceptions of good health, right? So for a really long time, sleep was just something that happened. And now doctors are much more attuned to taking seriously the centrality of sleep in our overall well-being, right? So we all recognize that a bad night's sleep has all sorts of effects on us, and lots of bad night's sleep have much more deleterious effects on us. So it's not that they're necessarily overblown. The challenge is, where the burden is placed, right? So what I really encourage people to try and think about is, like, rather than us bearing the burden of these kinds of institutional demands around when we need to be at a certain place, when we need to be working, when we need to be at school, can we adjust those institutions in ways so that we don't have to take a pharmaceutical or we don't have to be over-caffeinated in order to fulfill those institutional obligations, right?
And so then is that not just about having institutions be more flexible, but also in general, overall, working less, being less productive, in, you know, to use the phrase of our capitalist society?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you want to compare the United States to most other industrialized countries in the world, right, one of the things that we've done is rather than taking, increases in productivity in vacation time or less work time, we take it in increased wages, right? And if we, so there's a holiday that's coming up in October that I don't think anybody celebrates, which is called Take Back Your Time Day. I think it's October 24th. And what it's meant to mark is the amount of time Americans work more than everybody else in Western Europe, basically. So we're working between October 24th and the end of the year, and comparatively, they have that time off, right? So if we had more vacation time and lower wages, we would, have much more time to ourselves, to our families, to, recreate as we would, but we just might have decreased wages, and that's not something that's necessarily appealing to most people.
Right. And this connects to interviews that we've done on our program quite recently around a universal basic income and all of that. Yes. So, Matthew, I want to turn back to the basis of your research in your book. I understand that you spent time at the Midwest Sleep Disorders Clinic, and this area of very sort of rapidly growing research, medical research into sleep disorders, does it, have you found that we now label sleep disorders as disorders because we're simply looking for them? How prevalent are real sleep disorders and ones that doctors have only newly identified? Do we find that we sort of have more disorders than we've maybe had in the past simply because we're now identifying and diagnosing them as such?
Yeah, there's definitely the kind of categorization temptation, right? That now that there is a category for certain kinds of behaviors, more of those behaviors are fitting into those categories, right? So insomnia is something that seems way more prevalent than it used to be. The thing is that we didn't necessarily think about it in the way that we think about it now previously, and so people weren't looking for it in the same way. At the same time, so there's a lot of sleep disorders that are relatively rare. So things like narcolepsy or REM behavioral disorder affect less than 1% of the population. It's not the case that, because we have the diagnostic category that people are finding more and more narcolepsy these days. What seems to be more the case is that now that we have better treatments, people are more likely to diagnose people as fitting into a category that there's a treatment for. So something like obstructive sleep apnea, the treatments really didn't come together until the early 80s. It's really only in the last 15 years that those treatments have been really successful. And so it, behooves both patients and doctors to categorize patients as having that particular disorder so that they can get the right technology in order to be treated for it, right? So I don't think that, definitely the pharmaceutical market for things like insomnia is much bigger than we might want it to be. And people are probably categorizing one or two nights of poor sleep as insomnia in need of treatment. But it's not totally overblown.
Let me ask you, Matthew, from doing all your research, have you come to a conclusion that I've sort of suspected for a long time? I'm no expert, but does it feel like the idea of sleep is really based on an individual's both genetic predisposition and habits formed throughout life, much in the same way that, you know, issues of obesity and our relationship to food might be, that there are certainly naturally thin people and people who tend to gain weight just by looking at food. There are people who are naturally predisposed to be able to sleep 8 hours at night uninterrupted, or for that matter, any time of day that their lifestyle requires, and other people who really struggle because their bodies need certain amounts of sleep and at different times of day, that it's really an individual pattern that we have to identify rather than simply pathologizing those who can't fit into the prescription.
Yeah, I think that sleep is one of those things that we really don't have enough science about. The challenge is that because it's so everyday and it's so taken for granted, it's really difficult both to get scientists to take it seriously, but also to get funding to do that research, right? So, you know, we might have many more kinds of sleep types within a human population than we acknowledge. And we're just not really understanding it because nobody's doing the research to really get to it, right? I mean, there's people who are flexible sleepers. And when I was in college, I was one of those people, right? I could stay up all night, 5 nights a week, and it was totally fine with me and, you know, sleep during the day as I needed to. There's people who have a really hard time doing that. And, you know, the problem is that when you are generalizing that everybody should be sleeping in a consolidated way and it should always be around 8 hours, you're missing all of the people who might be 9 hour sleepers or might really thrive taking a nap or whatever, right? And so if we really tried to capture the diversity of human sleep, we'd probably have a much better understanding both of what sleep is and what sleep does and how we could actually fit it into society.
And then maybe we wouldn't need as much caffeine or as many sleep aids. Well, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and best of luck to you with your book.
Thanks for having me.
My guest is Matthew J. Wolfmeyer. He is an associate professor of anthropology at Binghamton University. And we've been talking about his book, The Slumbering Masses, Sleep, Medicine, and the Modern American Life.
We've been listening to Rising Up with Sonali. It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park in Portland. Swing dance lessons start an evening of live music with breaks included for short informational speeches about the life and history of jazz in the early 20th century. Again, that's Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park between Northeast 11th Avenue and Holiday Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director.